Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome, everyone. This is Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and we'd like to welcome you to today's teleconference town hall meeting on the difficult and challenging situation in Ukraine, Crimea, involving Russia, the U.S., and the European community. This has been an ongoing crisis for several months, starting with skirmishing over Ukraine's joining with some European community economic relationships versus Russia's pressure to have Ukraine stay closely bonded to Russia in economic terms. But of course, in the last couple of weeks, it has become very dramatic. We have with us today one of the greatest experts in this country and really the world on this region, especially Ukraine, but also Russia. And I'm delighted to welcome Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Ambassador Pfeiffer is director of the Brookings Institution Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution focusing on arms control, Russia, and Ukraine. He's on today with us from Washington, D.C. Ambassador Pfeiffer is a retired Foreign Service officer. He spent more than 25 years with the State Department focusing on U.S. relations with the former Soviet Union and Europe, as well as arms control and security issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs with responsibilities for Russia and Ukraine, as U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to his service in Ukraine and in Washington, he served at the U.S. embassies in Warsaw, Moscow, and London, and with the U.S. delegation to the negotiation on intermediate-range nuclear forces in Geneva. So again, welcome, Ambassador Pfeiffer. And let's just start this discussion with a recap of what the status of the situation in Kiev, in eastern Ukraine, in Crimea, between the U.S., Russia, and Kiev, et cetera.
Okay. Well, in the capital of Kiev, you have a government, an acting government, that's been in place now for just about 2 weeks following President Yanukovych having basically left the country and by all appearances, abdicating power. And the acting Prime Minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, will be in Washington tomorrow to meet with President Obama. Part of that, or the big part of that, is an effort by the United States to politically bolster the acting government by showing its political support for that government. The big issue that they're going to be talking about is going to be the situation in Crimea. And I should make a distinction here. When people talk about possible separatism within Ukraine, they sometimes link Crimea and eastern Ukraine. It's important to remember that in Crimea is the only region of Ukraine where ethnic Russians constitute a majority. In eastern Ukraine, ethnic Ukrainians are in the majority, and some of the press play about possible separatism in eastern Ukraine is a bit overplayed. While eastern Ukrainians may be uneasy about what's happened in Kyiv in the last month, I don't think many of them see separating from the rest of Ukraine as the answer. So that's a very different situation than you see in Crimea, which in effect over the last 10 days has been occupied militarily by the Russians. The troops on the streets now basically have no insignia. President Putin asserts that they are local militia. At a press conference last Tuesday, somebody asked him, well, how come they're wearing Russian-style combat uniforms? And his reply was, well, you know, you can get these uniforms in all kinds of army stores anywhere in the post-Soviet space. And the reporter did not think to ask him, well, can you buy the armored personnel carriers that are in the streets all over Crimea also in the same stores? Because there's definitely a lot of Russian equipment out there.
Right.
The latest development was last week the Crimean parliament voted for independence, and they have scheduled a referendum for Saturday, or I'm sorry, for this Sunday, at which there are two choices. Choice number one is joining Russia. Choice number two is to go back to the 1992 Crimean Constitution, which was unacceptable to Ukraine because it defined so much autonomy for Crimea that it was almost like an independent state. The choice that is not going to be offered, if somebody would like to vote for staying in Ukraine under the current constitutional arrangement, that's not an option on the referendum. I think it's a foregone conclusion how that referendum will turn out, and then the question is, what will the Russians do?
So what are the options as far as what the Russians will do?
Well, I think the Russians, there are three options, although I would be surprised if they considered seriously one. I mean, one option would be to recognize Crimea as an independent state. But if you look what happened when Russia recognized South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the two breakaway pieces of Georgia back in 2008, it proved politically and diplomatically embarrassing because today, in addition to Russia, only Nicaragua, Venezuela, and two small island nations in the Pacific recognize those two statelets. So my guess is the Russians probably won't pursue that option. The other two options, which are more likely, one would be just to annex Crimea, and in fact, the Russian parliament is looking at legislation that would simplify the procedures to take in foreign territories. Mm-hmm. And I think there will be a lot of thought in Moscow to doing that, although they probably have to recognize that that option really is then a much more severe challenge to the post-Cold War set of rules that have governed Europe. The other option would be to sort of leave Crimea in something of a limbo state. It had voted to leave Ukraine but not take it in, and then figure out a little bit later on what its ultimate status would be. And that might leave a glimmer of hope to Ukraine that they could someday reassert sovereignty over Crimea, but that's going to be, I think, a very difficult proposition.
If you had to bet, would you assume that Russia's going to annex Crimea?
My guess is at this point it's probably a 50-50 between the two options, annexation or leaving it in limbo status. And this will depend entirely on one person, Vladimir Putin, and the sorts of calculations that he's making in part on how harsh the response from the West would be. My own guess is that if they move towards annexation, the United States and probably most of Europe would favor escalating the sorts of sanctions that they've applied on Russia over the past week.
Mm-hmm. It seems that the Russian claims of repression against Russian nationals in Crimea are not very well verified. In other words, it doesn't seem like there's really a lot of repression. What's really at stake here for Russia? Why do they care so much?
Yeah, well, I would say that Russia had two primary interests in Crimea, above and beyond just the historical connection with Crimea, and particularly the port city of Sevastopol, having been founded to be the home port for the Black Sea Fleet. But interest number one was basically to be allowed to have access to the facilities in Crimea for the Black Sea Fleet and associated units. And going back to 1997, there's a basing agreement that allows that. And that agreement was extended in 2010 out to 2042. And there has been no suggestion in the last 2 weeks that the new government in Kyiv planned to challenge that. The second situation, or the second interest that Russia would have, is the status of ethnic Russians in Crimea. And although there have been lots of charges in the Russian media about threats to ethnic Russians, there was no credible evidence to suggest that there was any kind of problem like that. So one could have argued that if, in fact, Russians' interest in Crimea was on the Black Sea Fleet and the status of ethnic Russians, that those two concerns could have been handled by leaving Crimea in its present configuration as part of Ukraine. They were not threatened. But my guess is that this is not just about Crimea. There's a bigger game here.
So it's about leverage with Ukraine, denying the access to Ukraine, access to Crimea to Ukraine?
Well, and it's a pressure point. I mean, if you look at the way the Russians have acted over the last, say, 8 to 10 months, the Russians were very concerned about the prospect that Ukraine would sign an association agreement with the European Union, which had been negotiated. Basically, it was set for signing in November. And that association agreement basically would cause Ukraine to realign a lot of its regulations to EU standards, and a big part of it was a deep and comprehensive free trade arrangement with the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
It would have pulled Ukraine, if implemented, a long way towards Europe and a long way out of Moscow's geopolitical orbit. So,
and how would that hurt Russia? Why is that unacceptable to Russia?
Well, this is one of the curious things. People could understand why in 2008 Russia came up so hard on it against the idea of a membership action plan for NATO for Ukraine. And they pushed back very hard on that. The current Ukrainian government, or the previous government of Mr. Yanukovych, has made clear they don't want to pursue that. And my sense is the Ukrainian population is not interested in NATO membership. They may want to have cooperation with NATO, but there's not a lot of support within Ukraine for drawing closer to NATO. The European Union, though, is a different question. And while some assume that the European Union would not be seen in Moscow as a threat, it gets to this question of if the Ukrainians draw close to the EU, that really does loosen the connections to Moscow. And from Putin's point of view, he seems to be very interested in the sphere of influence. If Ukraine is actually moving in a very focused way towards Europe, that leaves a great big hole. And Ukraine, of course, has these long historical and cultural links with Russia.
So perhaps the Russians see an association with the EU as a step towards eventual NATO membership. It's a slippery slope down which Ukraine may proceed.
Yeah. I think for some there's that concern, although actually if I would – I don't see that sort of concern as having a realistic basis in the next 10 to 15 years within Ukraine. So I think the Russian concern was, even if you took the NATO factor out of this, again, having Ukraine move in that direction towards the European Union was simply unacceptable to Putin in geopolitical terms. And it was also, I think, a domestic political issue for him. The last couple of years, it's been pretty clear that Mr. Putin has lost the support of the middle class in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But for that conservative class that's out in the one factory towns in the rural areas, basically trying to bring Ukraine back towards Russia plays very well. And the flip side is, of course, being seen as lost Ukraine, having lost Ukraine would not have been something that Mr. Putin wanted to be tagged with.
Sure. So turning to the situation in Ukraine and the new leadership, I saw that former Prime Minister, or whatever he is, Yanukovych, stated today in Western Russia, where I guess he is located now, that it's a gang of ultranationalists who've taken over in Kiev. Is that the way you would characterize the new Ukrainian leadership?
Yeah, there has been a consistent effort by Moscow to basically say neo-fascist neo-Nazis are now in charge in Kyiv. When you look at the government, there are some very right-wing elements in that government. The Svoboda Party, which is a very strongly right party, primarily from Western Ukraine, and has had a troubling past. Our embassy out there has dealt with the party over the last couple of years, but has also been delivering a very hard message that says, if you want to be engaged and if you want to be regarded in the West as a mainstream party, you need to stop the anti-Semitic comments. You need to move more towards the center. And there's a sense that Svoboda may have recognized that and at least in their rhetoric has adjusted. Whether that really reflects where they are remains to be seen. But the other party, the Batkishchina party, this is the motherland party of former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, the woman who was in prison for 2.5 years and just released a couple of weeks ago. That's much more of a mainstream party, and Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the acting prime minister, and Oleksandr Turchinov, the head of the parliament and the acting president, both come from that party. So I think when you look at the government, there are some very strong right-wing elements. And it's important that as the U.S. and the West engage that government, we have to be very clear in our expectations in terms of what is acceptable and what is unacceptable political behavior. I think one of the deficiencies in the government is there are not really people in the government who represent Eastern Ukraine. And that's unfortunate, because if the government would have a stronger standing if it was seen as more inclusive. Now, my understanding is that when they were forming, they actually reached out to the Party of Regions. That's the party of President Yanukovych, who has now, as you said, made his second television appearance in Russia today since he fled the capital on February 21. But the Regions Party, which is his old party, which actually has since denounced him and is strong in eastern Ukraine, they apparently did offer a couple of ministerial portfolios to members of the Regions Party who turned it down. So there was some effort to bring in the East, but it failed.
So Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who's the prime minister at the moment, is 39 years old. He's a lawyer. He's a banker. He seems quite modern and interested in taking Ukraine to a new stage of economic development, focusing on science and technology and so on. Is that the way you see him? How is he bridging with the ultranationalists? Does he represent a main thrust for the leadership in Ukraine?
Yeah. Well, this is somebody who actually has a very impressive resume for a 39-year-old. He's served as the head of the National Bank, the Minister of Economy, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and also the head of the RADA. We actually had him at Brookings about a year ago for a public talk, and I had to tease him in my introduction that it just sounded like he really couldn't hold down a job. So he's got the credentials to be a prime minister. But I think one of the things that he will hear about in Washington is, you know, that there is it is important that his government be seen as reaching out to all parts of Ukraine. And what they have done, which is, I think, smart, is they now have an acting president, but they have set a date, May 25, for a new presidential election. Getting to that date, conducting a free and fair election process, which Ukrainians know how to do, and I think there will be a lot of assistance to help them get monitors in place and train electoral committees and things like that. But if they can do a free and fair election and then elect a president, that then gives them a leader who has full democratic legitimacy. The acting prime minister, the acting president, they came out of a very difficult, awkward situation, and they came to the rules by procedures that I think most in the West say were understandable. They probably took a couple of democratic shortcuts, but getting to May 25 and then getting an elected president would be a big gain in terms of having somebody which would be seen as fully vested in terms of legitimacy.
So all of the skirmishing about Crimea and so on really doesn't get to the major issues for Ukraine, which, as far as I'm aware, have to do with economic development, kind of the completion of the Orange Revolution, the really moving of Ukraine into a more modern economic system. Could you talk a little bit about what the real underlying issues are for Ukraine?
Yeah. Well, the problem is that Ukraine has a very weak economy due to poor management by Mr. Yanukovych, and also corruption. I mean, there are tales that Mr. Yanukovych now has billions of dollars stocked away. I don't know for sure, but you know, his son, who was a dentist by training, was fast gaining to be one of the richest businessmen in Ukraine entirely in that four-year period of his father's presidency. Andres Osland at the Peterson Institute here in Washington has estimated that about 3% of Ukraine's gross domestic product basically was built into contracts with selected oligarchs to transfer wealth from the national treasury. So if there was a contract for $100 million, they would kick up the price to $130 million, basically to get money into the hands of people associated with the president. So they've got to come to terms with the corruption. They've got to put in place sensible economic policies. And they're going to need help. I mean, their external financing requirements probably require on the order of $15 to $20 billion this year in order to avoid default. And the International Monetary Fund has a team which is in Kyiv now working to identify a program which will come with some very stiff conditionalities in terms of reforms that Ukraine has to undertake. And this will be painful. It's interesting, though, about 2 weeks ago, when he was named acting prime minister, Mr. Yatsenyuk went out and said, I'm going to be prime minister, but I'm going to head what he called a kamikaze cabinet. He said, because the things we're going to have to do, the decisions that we're going to have to take in the next several months, will be so painful economically, that nobody in this government is going to have any political standing in a few months.
Sure.
And I think one of the tricks is Ukraine has to make those hard steps, but the IMF has to also, I think, be a little bit sensitive to the politics in Ukraine, because you don't want a government that's on a reform course doing it so quickly and in a way that is so politically painful that it loses popular support.
So how can the Russians interfere, and will they interfere with the progression of Ukraine towards these reforms?
Yeah. Well, I worry that the Russians will still interfere, because even if at the end of the day the Russians de facto have Crimea, we'll see whether or not they move to try to annex it. But that isn't the whole game for the Russians, and it may not even be the main game, because if we look back and say what originally led the Russians to pressure against the association agreement with the European Union, it was about Ukraine drawing away from Russia. And I don't believe that Mr. Putin is going to say, fine, Crimea suffices, I'm prepared to let the rest of the Ukraine go.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia has a lot of leverages or a lot of levers that can make things difficult for Kyiv. I think the surprise to most analysts in the last couple of weeks was we assumed that Russia would do something to destabilize the new government in Kyiv. Most of us anticipated it would be economic levers, things like raising the price of gas, which they've now said they will do at the end of the month, cutting off certain imports from Ukraine into Russia, perhaps even stopping or reducing the flow of gas. They leaped over those measures to military action in Crimea, but they still have a number of economic levers that they can play that will make life in Kyiv more difficult. There's also the other concern, which I think most analysts think the concern has died down a bit, but about 10 days ago, as the Russians were placing military forces in Crimea, they were also conducting or finishing the conduct of a large military exercise north of eastern Ukraine. And there was a lot of worry that the Crimea action might have been accompanied by a major Russian military intervention into eastern Ukraine. In the end, the Russians did not do that, and I think that is a big reason. One is the Ukrainian forces, and actually Ukraine still has military forces in Crimea. They have been very restrained. They have stayed on their bases. They have not challenged the Russians. But most analysts assess that, had the Russians gone into eastern Ukraine, at least some elements of the Ukrainian military would have resisted, and you might have had a fairly major shooting war.
Mm-hmm. Other than denying Ukraine's allegiance to NATO or to the European community, what does Moscow have to gain by keeping Ukraine close to Russia? Its economy is not in very good shape. In a way, why is Russia, they're a consumer of energy, but it's usually at a discount. Is it the transit route for energy exports by Russia across Ukraine that's especially precious to the Russians? Why do they care so much here? And why would they want Ukraine to keep its economic relationship with Moscow?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of parts here. One is, I don't think that Mr. Putin is seeking to rebuild the Soviet Union, because he understands that if he did that, then Russia does end up inheriting a distressed Ukrainian economy and then has to subsidize that to the tunes of tens of billions of dollars each year. But what he does want is, again, this sphere of influence. And the main organizing organization that they've talked about in Moscow the last couple of years has been what they call the Customs Union, which now includes Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus. Armenia has agreed to join. And there really has been pressure on the part of Russia to get Ukraine to join the Customs Union, which Mr. Putin then says will ultimately evolve into a Eurasian Union on par with the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
The problem for Ukraine was, Ukraine basically said, we would like to do the association agreement with the European Union. And they said, we can't do a customs union with Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus because the rules are inconsistent. But they said, but we could do a free trade area with Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. Mm-hmm. The Russians said, no, you can't do both. You have to make the choice. And consistently going back to 2010, the Ukrainians just said, well, in that case, we choose the association agreement with the European Union. And my sense is that's not hard to understand. The cumulative gross domestic product of Europe is probably on the order of $15 to $17 trillion a year. and the cumulative gross domestic product of the customs union is somewhere between $2.5 and $3 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just for Putin, seeing Russia or seeing Ukraine go towards the European Union, that's simply unacceptable. He doesn't want to build the Soviet Union again, but he does want countries like Ukraine to defer to Moscow on issues that he deems of significant interest to the Russians.
I want to remind listeners that we're about halfway through our conversation here with Ambassador Steven Pfeiffer of the Brookings Institution and formerly Ambassador to Ukraine. And please, I have a few questions here on Twitter. You are welcome to send your questions to the Commonwealth Club at CW Club Ukraine. And I'm going to ask a couple of the questions that have come in, but please send me more. The U.S. has attempted to influence the situation by placing sanctions on Russia and so on. One questioner asks, what is the balance of power and influence between Russia and Germany? Can Angela Merkel do anything to stop Putin?
Well, at this point, I think Chancellor Merkel potentially could play a very big role. So far, the Germans have been seen as, within the European Union, among the ones that are less eager to go to sanctions quickly and to try to talk to Putin. And the Chancellor has had several conversations with Putin over the last couple of weeks. After one, she reportedly told President Obama, though, she said that Mr. Putin is in a totally different world. And that reflects the fact that there are just very different narratives as to what's going on in Ukraine, one held by the West, one held by the Russians. But potentially that she could be an important conduit to Putin. And I think what you see both in Germany, but also more broadly in the European Union and in the United States, is while they are moving forward on sanctions, things like they've all of the non-Russian members of the G8 have suspended preparations for going to the Sochi G8 summit in June. Many countries are looking at visa sanctions, asset freezes, things like that. And my guess is that those sanctions will be ratcheted up as if the Russians, you know, take further steps, including annexing Crimea. But at the same time, the West has been very careful to try to say there should and could be a diplomatic way out. What the U.S. government has talked about is this idea of a contact group that would include Russians, Americans, Europeans, and Ukrainians to try to define a political path forward. The problem that proposal has had, and virtually every other proposal for a dialogue, is the Russians maintain that the government in Ukraine is illegitimate, and so far they refuse to sit down and talk to them. Prime Minister Yatsenyuk says he's been trying for a week to call either the Russian president or the Russian prime minister. Nobody will take his calls.
And now, of course, the U.S. is saying that we've been willing to talk with the Russians, and the Russians are saying that the U.S. is not willing to talk with them, so the aspersions are flying back and forth. Let's focus just for a second on that question of legitimacy in Kiev. It looks as though the parliament, the Rada, impeached Yanukovych. How does the process work? And is it, in fact, an illegitimate government in legal terms, as far as we can tell?
Yeah. No, the Rada voted by about a three-quarters vote, basically, to remove Yanukovych as president. The shortcut, I think, that they took was it's actually a several-step process where the Rada has to look at it, then refer it to the Constitutional Court, then come back and take a second vote. And I don't think all of those steps were executed in a precise way. But it was kind of a difficult situation. On February 21, this was the day after these horrific shootings in Kyiv, where reportedly 60, 70 people were killed, mostly by snipers. Mm. And there was a negotiation that went overnight February 20 in the presence of the German, Polish, and French foreign ministers, and also a Russian representative, Ambassador Lukin. On February 21, Yanukovych and representatives of the three major opposition parties came to an agreement. And the agreement specified things like the creation of a national unity government. It called for adjusting the constitution so that there would be more of a balance of power between the prime minister and the parliament on one hand and the president on the other. And it called for moving the presidential elections, which were scheduled for March 2015, up to sometime in the fall. After signing this agreement, by all accounts, Mr. Yanukovych left the presidential administration, returned to his estate outside of Kyiv, packed up valuables, and disappeared. And that was the situation that now, it's not clear that that February 21 agreement could have been sold to the people on Maidan, the demonstrators. A day after having seen 70 fellow demonstrators basically shot down in cold blood, there was a pretty strong sentiment that Yanukovych should not be president for one more day, let alone until sometime in the fall. But there was never a chance really to test that because Yanukovych took off. He made a brief appearance in eastern Ukraine the following day, then disappeared for a week until he gave a press conference about 10 days ago in Russia, and then he made a very brief appearance today for about 10 minutes to read a statement and then did not take questions. So I just wanted to make one other aspect. I mean, the Russians now talk very much about the violations of the February 21st agreement as if it was the opposition that violated the agreement. I think the opposition's view is that, in fact, the agreement fell apart when Yanukovych fled, so he didn't stick around to carry out his part of it. And sure. The other ironic part is that for all of the attention the Russians now attach to that February 21 agreement, when the agreement was negotiated and finalized, the Ukrainians asked the German, Polish, and French foreign ministers and Ambassador Lukin to sign as witnesses. Ambassador Lukin, after consulting with Moscow, refused to sign.
Sure. So you mentioned the protesters on the Maidan. What do they want? What do the popular forces in Ukraine want?
That's evolved over time. The initial demonstrations started back on November 24th. And it was basically a protest, reportedly about 100,000 people turning out on a Sunday in Kyiv, a protest over the fact that President Yanukovych had said, we're not going to sign the association agreement.
Mm-hmm.
6 days later, on November 30th, the Berkut, these are special riot police in Ukraine, they have since been disbanded in the last 3 weeks. After the big demonstration on November 24, a small group basically set up a small tent protest camp. And about 4:30 in the morning on November 30th, the Berkut went in, attacked mostly college kids, college-age kids, put about 60 to 70 in the hospital. And the next day, about anywhere from 300,000 to 500,000 people turned out in protest, which was, I think, a gut reaction on the part of many Ukrainians against the use of force. I mean, there were more people put into the hospital on that one day than there were in 3 weeks of the Orange Revolution back in 2004.
And so it started out as a sympathetic protest towards association with the European Community.
Right.
But then it ended up being a much more massive protest against the heavy-handed tactics of the Yanukovych government.
Exactly. And then I think it became then further, you just saw the whole list of grievances against Yanukovych pour out about the corruption, about the authoritarianism. On January 16, they passed a set of laws which were basically would have made everything that the demonstrators were doing illegal. And that basically touched off the first violence about 3 days later. And this is one where, again, I think the history, is mixed. You had the Maidan, that stands for square in Ukrainian, and this was the Maidan Nezalezhnosti is the independent square in the center of Kyiv. That was the center of the Orange Revolution, and that was the center really of peaceful demonstrations. About two blocks over, though, you had Hushevsky Street, and that was where on January 19th you had the first clashes between demonstrators and police. There are charges, I think the reality was you had some ultra-nationalists in the demonstrators. I think it's fair to say that the demonstrators, certainly contributed to the clashes and may have even thrown the first rocks and the first Molotov cocktails. So that's part of this narrative which the Russians are trying to portray is that this is led by neo-fascists. But I think what you saw was, while they were certainly the instigators, there were people there who participated that were much more moderate but were simply acting out of frustration. Meanwhile, two blocks away, things were very quiet on the Maidan, and that was sort of a peaceful bastion of demonstration. But that was sort of the first flare-up, and then you had several days of violence, and then the real problems took place the week of February 17, where on the morning of February 17, a deal was brokered whereby the government agreed to amnesty demonstrators who had been arrested, and the demonstrators agreed to evacuate government buildings around the Maidan Square that they had occupied. That happened on Monday. The next day, on Tuesday, there was a protest march from the Maidan up to the parliament building about a half mile away. And again, it's not clear whether the police started it or the demonstrators started it, but whoever started the violence, it was quickly escalated by the police with stun grenades, rubber bullets, and in some reports, using live ammunition. And then that night, there was actually a physical attack using a couple of armored personnel carriers on the Maidan, which was seen as crossing the line because the Maidan, again, had been this area where demonstrations were largely peaceful. And that escalated 2 days later to this horrific scene where you had snipers on the tops of buildings basically shooting protesters in cold blood.
What's the worst case of Russian pressure and influence and the future of Ukraine?
Well, I think the worst case scenario, although the risk now seems less than it was, say, 10 days ago, would be a broader Russian military intervention into at least eastern Ukraine. But my guess is that from the perspective of the Russian military, I think that they appreciate that even though they would prevail over the Ukrainian army, they do understand that some elements of the Ukrainian army in those circumstances would fight. So there would have to be some fighting. And you might also have a number of Ukrainians from western Ukraine basically going east to perhaps even start something like a guerrilla campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is that the Russian military, you know, saw Crimea as one situation, but is not eager to go into eastern Ukraine. And hopefully that will deter them from action, which I think then would get very ugly both between Russia and Ukraine, but then would, I think, force the United States and Europe to consider, you know, even more robust options in terms of punishing Russia.
Other than the targeted sanctions that are now being applied, what can the U.S. and the West do? I mean, does this go as far as OSCE observers, or what are the options if we want to try to protect Ukraine's ability to retain its independence, but also to develop in the way that many Ukrainians want it to develop without a corrupt government and with a more modern economy?
Yeah, well, one of the ideas, of course, and one of the proposals that have been backed by the United States is to get OSCE, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, monitors into Ukraine. And they've actually been trying since the middle of last week to deploy to the island of peninsula of Crimea, but they have been prohibited by, I believe they're Russian soldiers. These local militias wearing Russian-style uniforms and looking very much like a trained military unit, who basically have been refusing to allow them entry into Crimea proper.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a good idea to, though, in any case, put some of those monitors into eastern Ukraine so that there could hopefully be an unbiased source of information as to, is there any pressure on ethnic Russians? What's actually happening? Because there have been some demonstrations pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian, and there have been some clashes. But it would be good to have ground truth from the OSCE as to what's going on in eastern Ukraine. In terms of other measures, I mean, there are steps politically and diplomatically to isolate Russia. There are these now targeted visa sanctions. The American government has now basically targeted for visa sanctions and potential asset freezes people, and they don't specify nationality, but it could be Russian and Ukrainian, who take actions to weaken Ukraine's sovereignty or territorial integrity. And I think there are a list of other options, including further economic sanctions, which would be difficult, or I would say not easy for the West to impose, because there could be potential costs for the West as well, but that might inflict some economic damage on Russia. Interestingly, I mean, one of the things just sort of happens on its own. Russia is far more integrated into global markets than the Soviet Union was. And on Monday, a week ago, this was the day after it was very clear that the Russian military had gone big time into Crimea, the Moscow Stock Exchange crashed. It lost about 12% value in its first hour. And the ruble has now fallen to its lowest point compared to the dollar ever. So being integrated in the global economy has some benefits. But also, in Russia's case, they're also seeing that markets do not like war. And you know, one big question out there is, what will this mean for investment into Russia at a time when Russia has a relatively stagnant economy? Are Western investors now going to be less eager to put money into Russia when there's a great uncertainty about, you know, where Vladimir Putin is going to go?
There was an interesting article in the New York Times this morning about Putin having taken a very coherent course to persuade business leaders and oligarchs in Russia to bring their money home, to not invest so much abroad and really not be so connected into the world economy.
Yes.
But to be highly invested in the Russian economy, making them less susceptible to pressure in any way that would undercut or oppose Putin's policies.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. He's wanted to do that. The problem that Mr. Putin has, though, is the Russian economy is so corrupt that most oligarchs and people with money in Russia are reluctant to keep all of their resources in Russia for fear that there may be arbitrary decisions that take that money away. So a lot of people have found that there's much more safety and security in putting that money, for example, into banks in London. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Putin would like to bring that back. But again, I think those who bring the money back also have to understand that there is perhaps then some risk that money may be taken in a way that they did not face that kind of risk when the money was in a Western financial institution.
Sure. Secretary Kerry made an interesting comment about Putin's behavior not being a 21st century way of having influence on your neighbors, essentially. Meaning, I suppose, that there are other ways through legitimate business relationships and through political relationships to relate to your neighbors and try to influence them, but without this heavy-handed approach.
I think Secretary Kerry's point is, you know, in the 21st century, you're much smarter using diplomacy, political means, and soft power rather than military force. And you know, what the Russians have done in Crimea has, I'm sure, some unintended consequences. Within Ukraine, for example, they haven't yet done a poll, but you know, what you're hearing from Ukrainians is the Russians are succeeding in uniting us. I have to think that for Eastern Ukrainians, even those who may have voted for Yanukovych 4 years ago, who may be uncomfortable with how Yanukovych fled and you know are not fully sure that the interim government in Kyiv you know has full legitimacy, I think that this Russian occupation, this military seizure of Crimea, is probably going to help unite them with you know, Western Ukrainians. And it will be very interesting to see what polls say, you know, how strong the push now in all of Ukraine is to draw closer to the European Union.
Sure. There are a few questions coming in via Twitter about, again, what's at stake for Russia in a more material sense. Do Crimea and eastern Ukraine have natural gas or other resources that Russia covets? Are there Russian oligarchs who would like to get their hands on industry and resources in eastern Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, Crimea itself does not have huge resources. There may be some offshore oil deposits in the Black Sea, but the primary value in Russian eyes of Crimea is that, you know, if they physically control it as opposed to it being a part of Ukraine, they physically control those bases that are very important to the Black Sea fleet. In terms of industry, there are some industries, primarily in eastern Ukraine, that might be of interest to the Russians. A lot of these industries were very interwoven during Soviet times, and in fact, there still is a considerable economic business links between Ukraine and Russia, resulting from that legacy of the Soviet economy.
The big thing I think that the Russians covet is the gas pipeline system that transits through Ukraine, because the Russians are trying to get around Ukraine, but they still export about 60 to 70% of the gas that they sell to Europe goes through Ukraine. And that's probably Russia's largest hard currency, largest export earner at the moment. They export probably on the order of 100 to 120 billion cubic meters of gas each year to Europe, and the bulk of that goes through Ukraine. Now, the Russians are trying to change that equation. They've already laid one pipeline under the Baltic Sea known as Nord Stream. They're building a second pipeline in the Baltic, and they're talking about building pipelines in the Black Sea that would allow them to move gas around Ukraine. And this would position the Russians to avoid the situation they had in 2006 and 2009 when they had a gas price dispute with Ukraine. And there was also, I think, some political motivations on the Russian side, but they found that they could not cut off gas to Ukraine without cutting off gas to Europe.
So let's talk for a moment. We're just a little ways from ending our conversation. Let's talk about steps and solutions and things that countries can do and that individuals can do to help with the situation. On the level of countries' actions, one Twitter writer asks, can Ukrainian forces exercise with multinational military in NATO Cooperation Program Partnership for Peace? Could there be scenarios like that to assist Ukraine?
Well, NATO and Ukraine have exercised a lot in the past, and in fact, actually, Ukraine has been a very active participant in NATO partnership military activities. In fact, they just had one of their warships return to the Black Sea, not to Crimea, but it's headed for Odessa in Ukraine proper. But it participated in a NATO-led counter-piracy effort off the Horn of Africa. I think right now that kind of exercise, though, might be a little risky in terms of internal divisions within Ukraine, where eastern Ukraine may still be suspicious of a too overt engagement by NATO. So it's best to let the European Union take the lead institutionally. Now, you have seen steps taken within NATO in the last several days, U.S. deployment of F-15s to Lithuania, F-16s to Poland, that are designed, I think, to reassure the Central European states, those states that still have a somewhat raw memory of the Soviet Union and are physically closer to Russia. But those are really designed to, I think, bolster confidence on the part of NATO allies. When we look at what the U.S. and the West are doing for Ukraine, it pretty much stays on the political, diplomatic, and economic level. You know, my guess is that there probably is nobody seriously in the West who's prepared to go to war over Crimea, and I think the Ukrainians understand that.
What about groups, nonprofit organizations, people-to-people groups, individuals? What can they do to help the situation? By which I would assume it means we mean helping to steer Ukraine away from the ultranationalists towards a modernization-oriented government and to try to help in any way diminish the current standoff and tension with Russia.
Yeah, no, I think certainly when I served in Ukraine, people-to-people exchanges that exposed Ukrainians to how people dealt with problems in the West were always useful. And also, I mean, I found a lot of times Americans would come away and say, you know, I came here to teach some things, but I actually learned some things that will be useful when I get back home. So those sorts of exchanges, I think, can be very useful. But they're probably more useful in the long term. At this point, it seems to me that the way to ratchet down the tensions turns first on, is there some way to bring Russia to basically saying, okay, there needs to be a political way out of this, and at least to begin a dialogue. And that doesn't mean that the Russians give everything up at the beginning, but they've at least got to be prepared to have some kind of a conversation with Ukraine. That won't be an easy conversation, but it's hard to see how we get a political process started if Moscow is simply refusing to recognize the authorities in Ukraine as a legitimate interlocutor.
Are there any groups or organizations in Russia who can be influenced and agitated to try to influence the Putin government? I know that that's a hard thing to do, but any levers of influence with Russia that either governments or groups, citizens, and nonprofit groups can engage?
Yeah, I think that's worth exploring, but that's a pretty tough hill to climb. I think for what we've seen in at least some of the anecdotes and some of the polling is that, in fact, this activity has been quite popular in Russia. I think that's unfortunate. It was interesting, there was a poll about 2 weeks ago that suggested, well, Russians were, as a people, not happy about what was going on in Ukraine, that they had concerns. I think some of the concerns were artificially stoked by the fact that if you're watching Russian television now, you're getting a very one-sided picture of what's going on in Ukraine, where there are threats to ethnic Russians, where there are neo-fascists in control, which I don't think reflects the reality. But even then, while being concerned, a poll 2 weeks ago showed about 70% of Russians basically said, let's stay out of it, it's not our business. I think what's happened now is that Mr. Putin has, you know, at least in Crimea, very directly made it the business of the Russian military. There does seem to be, you know, a support for that from the part of the broader public. And that may make it harder for non-governmental groups in the United States or in Europe who are trying to reach out and engage in a dialogue with Russian counterparts. It may make it hard to find Russian groups that you can communicate with.
Does this pattern of Russian behavior concern you about possibly other countries, other regions on the border of Moscow, or elsewhere in the world? Are we seeing a new, much tougher line and in the Putin approach to this situation?
Yeah, I think it is a reason to be concerned. I mean, people go back to the antecedent of Georgia. And I think when you look at what happened between Russia and Georgia in 2008, the Russians were ready for a fight. But I would argue that the reason that war between Russia and Georgia began on August 7, 2008 was because President Saakashvili made a very ill-advised decision to send his army into South Ossetia in a way that the Russians would only respond to with force. This is different than that because, again, there was no evident military threat to Russian installations in Crimea. There was no threat to ethnic Russians. This was a preemptive move by the Russian military. And what's worrisome is if you go back to what the Russians have said, including what President Putin said at his press conference a week ago, where he talked about Russia asserting for itself the right to defend any Russian compatriots. And compatriot is a very interesting term because it doesn't mean Russian nationals, Russian passport holders. Mm-hmm. In Moscow's eyes, that means Russian speakers or it means ethnic Russians. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why there are more American F-15s flying over the Baltic states now than there were, say, a week ago.
Sure.
Because in a country like Latvia, Estonia, both NATO members, where the population is 20 to 25% ethnic Russian, I think those governments are probably a bit more anxious than they were 2 weeks ago.
Sure. Well, one key factor is Ukraine's economic dependence on Russia through the energy supplies, through the natural gas supplies. And ultimately, Ukraine's independence will be sustained if it is more economically independent. So I do think that any collaboration that we can do, companies and individuals can do with Ukraine to increase its economic independence and develop more self-sustaining energy supplies would be helpful.
I think that's right. Ukraine now is usually dependent on Russian energy. They have made some progress. Ukraine now consumes about 50 to 55 billion cubic meters of gas a year, of which they produce only about 20 billion cubic meters. The rest comes from Russia. When I was in Kyiv, they were using 80 billion cubic meters a year, and they were importing 60 billion. So through conservation, primarily because of higher energy prices, which has forced firms in Ukraine to make smarter decisions about how they use energy, they're reducing their energy consumption. But they should have the ability. There's actually both Chevron and Shell are in eastern Ukraine and western Ukraine trying to develop unconventional gas sources. Ukraine may have the second or third biggest reserves of unconventional gas in Europe. And if they can do that, which is going to require that the Ukrainian government maintain a good investment climate, set reasonable prices, but if they can do that, there's a chance that within 7 to 10 years they could be producing substantial amounts of natural gas domestically that could supplant what they import from Russia.
So this is a situation and a conversation that obviously is not going to end. It's going to be ongoing for many months. I'd like to thank you, Ambassador Pfeiffer, Steve, for bringing your expertise and your wisdom to bear on this subject for this audience on the phone today. I know there were a number of people on the phone because I was getting lots of Twitter questions. And so we'll continue to monitor the situation. Thank you not only for your expertise and contributing your thoughts, but for your tireless work to bring better understanding in the outside world of Ukraine and that part of the world and all of the great work you've done through diplomacy.
Dori, thank you very much for having me.
All right, and we'll say goodbye to our audience now and see you again at the Commonwealth Club in person or at a future phone conference. Thank you and all the best to everyone.